Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
One of the most famous psychological experiments ever done is called the attention blindness, or gorilla experiment. Here's how it goes. Researchers sit their subjects down in front of a video of a basketball game. They tell them to count the number of passes made. In the middle of the game, a guy in a gorilla suit walks past the court in full view of the camera. The researchers ask their subjects who saw the gorilla. More than half did not. They were so focused on counting the passes, they never noticed the gorilla. It's astonishing and amusing, but there's a deeper lesson, according to Duke University's Kathy Davidson. She's the author of Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. Davidson believes attention blindness is one of the most fundamental aspects of the human brain. She tells Anne Strangechamps why.
Since I'm interested in technology and the way the new information age allows us to collaborate worldwide with people like ourselves, I'm really interested in the possibilities for that person who sees the gorilla, the half that see the gorilla and the half who don't see the gorilla, to work together and maybe together see the whole picture. Because, in fact, there's two different ways of seeing. If you're not particularly paying attention to the task of counting the basketballs, of course you see the gorilla. In fact, you can't believe that other people are missing it. So I've come up with a method called collaboration by difference, and this nonprofit organization that I co-founded called Haystack, it operates on the tradition of collaboration by difference, where we're constantly putting together teams of people with different cultures, different languages, different expertise, and different tasks they have to conduct. Not just because of their own expertise at their task, but because when you're not paying attention to someone else's task, you actually see things about that that they miss. And that's really beneficial in a larger sense. But it's a very different way of learning. We're used to measuring individual achievement. My argument is that in this era, what we need to know is how to measure, how to reward collaborative achievement. That's what the World Wide Web is about.
It's sort of common wisdom, on the other hand, that it's our ability to focus in a very sustained way on something that's also behind high performance in almost any subject.
It is, except that we have very crude measures for what we mean by being able to focus. When people are actually tested, even when they're in test situations where they think they're focusing, after about 5 minutes, their mind starts wandering. And you only know this by interruption. In fact, Jonathan Schuller has done some great experiments where he has people reading text in a time situation, and he'll break into the test before the test is done and say, "What are you thinking about now?" And about half the time, the person is not actually reading the text that they're being tested on. They're thinking about lunch or a nap or why am I taking this stupid test? You know, in other words, we don't know our mind is wandering until we're interrupted. And that's interesting because we're now living in a new era with new technology. So we're all being interrupted a lot of the time. And we're becoming aware of practices that, in fact, we've been succeeding in our whole lives. We just weren't aware of them before.
Well, most of us think of that as a bad thing. Our distractibility, we think, is something that we should weed out. You have a really interesting suggestion that we start multitasking our attention. And you describe multitasking, in fact, as the ideal mode of the 21st century. Why?
Bottom line, I think we have a myth of monotasking. The brain is not a monotasker. The Cambridge group and Marcus Rackley at Washington University in St. Louis have found that the brain spends about 80% of its neural energy talking to itself. The brain chatters all the time. The brain is constantly distracted. There would be a lot more Buddhas in the world if we were good at monotasking. Because in meditation, in the whole 5,000-year history of Eastern practice, you get into a situation where you're totally undistracted. You're in a quiet room. You're meditating. You're just supposed to be thinking about one thought, which is basically being. And you can't do it. Your mind goes crazy when it's not focusing. But again, we're not aware of our own distractions. On the other hand, if we can make ourselves, if we can be introspective, if we can realize that, in fact, our attention is various all the time, we can use that as a tool to productively work with others to compensate for the key moments when our own attention might wander, or, this is the part that I think is the most interesting, where disruption of our attention will actually make us see something big, maybe even a gorilla.
Are you saying multitasking and distractibility are actually good things?
I think they're the same thing. That in fact, what multitasking means is in that situation, you happen to be aware that you're doing multiple tasks. There's almost nothing we do as human beings that's monotasking. I mean, think about it. If you walk across a busy street and you're talking to a friend, that's cognitively an incredibly challenging multiple task. You're talking, you're looking at traffic, you're walking, you're engaged in whatever the emotional content of the conversation is. And needless to say, if there's a lot of cars coming, you better stop talking because you're endangering yourself every bit as much as you would be if you were walking across the street by yourself and texting. However, we're used to the behavior of walking across the street and talking to friends. So that's a habit. We don't even really process that as multitasking. It's just everyday life. Whereas the walking across the street texting, we think of as a terrifying thing. In fact, it is frightening. It does increase your chances of accidents, but so does talking to your friend in an emotional situation on a busy street. But we don't have categories for what is habitual. We only make categories, and we only think of as disruption those things that are new and are entering into our landscape for a first time.
In 2003, you were a provost at Duke, and you were involved in a project that is referred to often as the iPod experiment. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's a little bit wicked. There was not at the time a single known two-directional use of the iPod. An iPod was just something you used to listen to music on, basically a radio that you could download music on, but you couldn't broadcast at that time. And Apple came to Duke and said, what technology would you like to have experiment with in your classes? And I was part of a group that said, let's use that one because students are interested in it. And it would be great to get students to think about how this iPod could be used for learning. There were no known learning uses. Well, we got creamed. Newsweek said we were ruining education, et cetera, et cetera.
You handed out free iPods to all the incoming freshmen.
We did. And of course, the people who were most mad at us were the sophomores, juniors, and seniors who said, we paid Duke tuition. Why didn't we get a free iPod? And we said, oh, darn, we didn't think of that. Well, that was a little manipulative, I guess, because what we said was, so here, how about this? We made a mistake, so we'll give you a free iPod too, as long as you can come up with a learning use for the iPod. And you can convince a professor to change a syllabus to include an iPod in the class. Well, within one semester, there was practically no department that hadn't come up with some pretty amazing use of the iPod, with professors being willing to change their syllabuses to incorporate them.
Like what? What sort of things did students come up with?
Well, amazing things. Biomedical engineering students found a way that you could put an iPod earbud in one ear and a stethoscope earphone in another ear and listen to someone's heart and change the signal processing to get the catalog of heart arrhythmias from the National Institute of Health. And you could actually do citizen medicine. So a nurse practitioner could have a new repertoire of heart arrhythmias to listen to and help diagnose a heart condition. Well, this was the beginning of telemedicine, which was pretty revolutionary to come up with. Music students found a way that a student could sing in a quartet and drop their voice into a famous quartet and hear how they would sound with Pavarotti or a very famous tenor.
I also wanted to ask you about another educational proposal you had. Well, I guess you put into practice. This is crowdsourcing grading.
Yes. One thing we don't do very well in our educational system is prepare our students for a future and for their present where they're constantly giving and receiving feedback online. I mean, the whole thing about the internet is publish early, revise later. You have an idea, you publish that idea. But what does it mean to put yourself out there to a public that anyone can either attack or even constructively give feedback to? So I've changed the model of my classes to make feedback and collaboration and student and peer-driven learning the model of my classes. So I teach seniors, so I know they've had a strong background in other things. So this is kind of a class they typically take before they graduate. So it's to shake them up and make them unlearn just when they think they've got a diploma with an easy grasp. And what I do is I write a syllabus for my class. It's called This Is Your Brain on the Internet. But every week, two students run the class, and they read. They're required to read what I've put on the syllabus, and they have to make a decision whether they're going to teach what I've assigned, add to it, or get rid of it and teach something completely different. But if they do that, they have to make a case to me and to the students for why they're choosing something else. They then set the syllabus. They set the assignments. They grade the assignments. They give students a chance to revise their work to get satisfactory work. And then the students write evaluations of those two teachers. And then the next week, those teachers are students again, and the process begins again. So students become very respectful of one another, but it's also they become respectful of learning in a very, very powerful way, that learning is something we all contribute to together. And we can do that in negative ways, or we can learn to do it in very positive and fruitful ways that help us all.
When you first wrote about that, you got savaged in the press. I mean, people said, you know, well, why should we bother paying you a salary if you're going to have the students teach?
I know. And of course, and anyone who's taught knows that this is 10 times more labor intensive. In this kind of situation, I'm constantly working with the students and helping them craft the best possible learning experience for the other students. I'm giving them feedback. I say, look at that again. How would you feel if that were being given to you as feedback? Would you get resentful, or would you respond well to it? And if they say I would get resentful, I say, how would you recast it so it would be more effective?
But I can see your critics having a point, because there's an underlying philosophical issue here, right, which has to do with a paradigm shift from a top-down model, authoritative, hierarchical model of teaching or working, you know, because this is equally applicable to the workplace. So it's shifting from this authoritative top-down structure that we all are very familiar with to something mushy.
Right. Basically, from the 1890s onward, we've been taught that teaching is about how to learn something from somebody else and how to get a good grade on a standardized test. If Newton or Galileo or Leonardo da Vinci had heard that the pinnacle of intelligence for people in the 21st century was how well you filled in bubble tests on a time test, and that that's what would get you into law school or medical school or graduate school, they would think the lemmings had gone off the cliff. That's a very enforced and recent way of measuring and actually teaching a subject. Typically, you teach in the model of an apprentice, where somebody has a skill and someone's learning it, and they learn it by reading about it and doing it, and then they get corrected, and they do it a little bit different. They do it a little bit different. It's a very interactive process, very different than the lecture model. Also, when I talk to corporations, and I've been on this book tour where about half the people I talk to are educators and half are in the business world, they always tell me in this job market they can hire the very, very, very best students. And it takes them about 1 to 2 years to get the very best students to realize there's no teacher giving me an A. There's no time test. There's no one answer. I have to have some initiative in the workplace. If I don't know something, I can't fake it. I have to find somebody who does know it and figure out how to work together to solve a problem. That's a really different way of thinking about the workplace, but that's the workplace of the present. We're doing a great job of educating our students for the 20th century. The workplace has changed far more radically than our educational institutions. And that, to me, is a tragedy. We're not doing a good job of preparing students for their future. We're doing a good job of preparing them for our past.
Kathy Davidson is the author of Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. She spoke with Anne Strange Champs.